Good morning, everyone. Happy Labor Day weekend. So this morning, I'm going to be talking about our Zen practice as being defiantly resilient and unsentimentally exuberant. That's kind of a mouthful. I'm going to offer you the hypothesis that our practice can have all four of these qualities, and you can sort of decide for yourself whether or not that hypothesis makes sense. But I think, and I've experienced, I guess, my practice and the practice of others as being defiant, resilient, unsentimental, and exuberant. And I got the idea for this talk in a kind of an unusual place. I was reading an album review from Robert Christgau. Some of you might know him, from 1986. And he was reviewing an album that was released in 1986 called The Indestructible Beat of Soweto. For those of you who are music nerds, you know this album. It is a classic. But in his review, he says, in part, it's a rather lengthy review, but he says, as he's reviewing the music on this album, this music thwarts apartheid's determination to deny blacks not just a reasonable living, but a meaningful identity. The defiantly resilient and unsentimental exuberance of these musicians has to be fully absorbed before it can be believed, much less understood. They couldn't be more into it if they were inventing rock and roll. This is a positive album review, by the way. If you have not heard the record, I highly recommend it. The Indestructible Beat of Soweto. And in case it's helpful for context, Soweto is a township, is what they call it in South Africa. We would call it a shanty town, or a ghetto, maybe, to the southwest of Johannesburg. Soweto is southwest township. It's huge. Huge. Thousands and thousands of people live there and have for a long time. It's where Nelson Mandela lived, Desmond Tutu lived, actually still does, has a house there. A cultural hotspot, a musical hotspot, and a major source of a lot of the anti-apartheid movement in the late 80s. So, I'm going to talk about these four qualities today, and we'll explore them together, sort of see how it feels. But the connection when I was reading this, when I was reading this review, I didn't have a talk coming up, so it wasn't like, I got to think of an idea, I got to squeeze it out of whatever's in front of me. It was more as I was reading this, I went, oh yeah, that's just then. That's just then. So when it arises in my mind in that fashion, I tend to trust it a little bit more than if I'm trying to force it. So, I'll start with the first one, defiant. And I know we have the AC running. Can everybody hear me? Okay, you cannot hear me? Do you want to be able to hear me? Okay. Go ahead and kill it and we'll see what happens. Hi. Have you heard anything thus far? A little bit? You're at Zen Center? How about you guys back there? Can you hear okay? All right. Thank you. Thank you for doing that. So defiant. Defiant. One way of looking at Buddhism in general and Buddhist practice, and this certainly applies to the Zen form of Buddhism, is that from its very inception, it's a counterculture. It's defiant from the very, very beginning. It's a rebellion. Essentially, it's a gentle rebellion, an understanding one, a compassionate one, but it's a rebellion nonetheless. The inherent refusal in Buddhism and in Buddhist practice to live by what is unhelpful or by what is untrue, whether those are social standards or personal narratives, is part of the reason we work with the mind. We just say no over and over to the thing that isn't true. Right? Our devotion, our allegiance is to the truth, to reality, which of course involves saying no to that which doesn't reflect reality or is inherently untrue. In the story of the Buddha, of course, he leaves home, he leaves his inheritance, he leaves his family as a way of saying, no, I know those things don't work for what I want to do. They don't work. I will say no, and I leave them for what I don't know, actually, at that point. And the early Sangha flew in the face of many social conventions of that age. Obviously, the Buddha chose to accept people from all castes. The caste system would have been alive and well in ancient India, of course, and choosing to break that by allowing anybody in and for them to interact, eat together. Huge. Unheard of. I won't even pretend to imagine that I know what that would be like, because it's so alien to my experience. But discarding the caste system, admitting women into the Sangha, his principles of non-harm, non-violence, were as radical at 500 BC as they still are today. Right? These are acts of rebellion. They are flying in the face of, they are a skillful response to, much of our cultural conditioning, much of what we've come to accept as normal. So there's a feeling from the very beginning of rebellion and countercultures. And, you know, this shows up in lots of different ways. And obviously when I hear the word defiant or when I hear the word rebellious, I immediately overlay the emotion of anger, because that's how it's oftentimes shown up in my life. That's certainly true. It can obviously have that tone, but it doesn't have to have that tone. Our no can be very strong and very firm and very gentle. Our no does not have to come from a place of anger. Defying something like a social convention or defying something like an unhelpful or untrue belief does not have to come from a place of constriction or fear or anger. That no can come from a place of just recognizing what is true. Right? No matter how many times somebody tells you, you're a horse, you're a horse, you're a horse, you're unlikely to believe them. You don't even have to get angry about it. You can just go, oh, sweetie, you're wrong. I'm a person. Right? That's the type of no. When we begin to really recognize the fruits of unskillful thought, unskillful action, as being unskillful, as being violent, divisive, rooted in ignorance or greed, it's much easier to say no to them, to let them go voluntarily. I'll choose something else. So it's that type of a rebellion. So I'll take you back to South just a minute. One of the times, the first time I was in South Africa leading a pilgrimage, our theme was truth and reconciliation. And we were using the apartheid regime and the cultural reaction to apartheid, both pre and post, as our theme. We visited a lot of different sites related to apartheid, and we were fortunate enough, blessed enough, to attend a very small mass offered to us by Archbishop Tutu. A lot of you know Desmond Tutu, or certainly have heard the name. And we met with him very briefly afterwards. And even if you're not familiar with the intimacies of South African politics, you probably know enough about Archbishop Tutu to know that his entire life basically has been one of defiance. Gentle defiance for the most part, but kind of a non-stop, kind, faith-based and iron-willed defiance. He defied apartheid, of course. He defied the government. He defied the police with his ministry in the way that he manifested his faith. And he continues to defy the dogma of his own religious tradition, the Anglican Church, with statements that always make people angry, like, God isn't a Christian. They don't like hearing that. I do. I think it's genius. But he certainly broke the rules when he offered me, Buddhist clergy, dressed as Buddhist clergy, the sacrament, gave me communion, you know, the Eucharist, along with everybody else. And when I met him very, very briefly after the Mass, he took my hand in both of his. You know how people do that sometimes? And he looked kind of right through me, and he said, please pray for us. And when I think about that moment, I think, that's defiance. That's the most gentle defiance in the world. But think of what's happening about be what's happening there in his heart to ask me, the person I am, the race I am, dressed the way I am, to pray for him. Wow, that's defiance. That's fantastic. How many social conventions, how many rules has he just broken by doing that? No anger at all. Just wanted to connect with me, you know. So I did. Of course, I still do. Pray for him, for Cape Town. And the rakasu that I wore to Mass that day, while I was on pilgrimage, I wore the rakasu. It's a pilgrimage robe in a lot of ways. This could be seen as a symbol of rebellion, of a massive rebellion in human culture. One of the stories that we're hearing now, and of course no one really knows, a lot of the stuff was unrecorded, but one of the stories that I've heard more recently in the last couple of years about the origin of this garment is that it dates to 6th, 7th century China during one of the periods in Chinese history of persecution of Buddhism. One of those periods when it's, nope, you don't get to be a Buddhist, you can be a Taoist or a Confucianist, but if you're a Buddhist, we're going to kill the nuns, kill the monks, tear down temples, break statues. That's what governments have a tendency to do. It's what humans have a tendency to do, I'm sad to say. But the robe, of course, for a nun or for a monk is a profound symbol of their commitment to non-harm, of their commitment to living by a way of awakening. And they hold that symbol very close. Physically very close, because of course it's a garment, right? So the version that I downloaded online is the rakasu is a miniature version of a standard okesa, or robe, worn around the neck, a garment of Chinese origins, probably dating back to the periods of the Buddhist persecutions. Legend holds that when the Chinese emperors forbid the wearing of robes and they defrocked all of the nuns and monks, the nuns and monks created a miniature version of their robe to be worn secretly around the neck underneath their regular lay clothing. After the persecutions were over, though, the wearing of the rakasu continued. Chan Buddhism was studied by Dogen, who traveled from Japan to China, returning to Japan with his knowledge of Chan Buddhism and his knowledge of the rakasu. So I don't know if that represents historical truth or not. It rings spiritually true to me. Necessity sort of being the mother of invention, I guess. You invent something when you kind of need to. So something small you can keep secret and wear underneath your clothes to avoid being killed. Seems like a pretty good reason to invent something, I guess. And my other story about the rakasu, I'm going back to South Africa one last time, was when I was there last, we visited a huge Chinese Mahayana Buddhist temple. Like, huge, huge. It was like, there was room and boards for hundreds of people, massive temples. It was just giant, giant. The huge Chinese population in South Africa. And this temple was built to kind of meet their needs. Sutra chanting and weddings and funerals and meditation, all this kind of stuff. And so we were there for just one afternoon, and it was cool. We had a beautiful little Chinese monk offer us Zazen instruction, and of course in Chinese. It wasn't helpful to me, but the translator was doing his best to sort of translate this, and he had us all sitting, you know. And afterwards, after our sitting, we all kind of filed out past him, and again, I'm wearing my practice clothing, and so is he. We're dressed the same way. And so as I pass him, of course, he doesn't speak much English, but as I pass him, he says, "Brother?" I say, "Yes, brother." Oops. It was a wonderful moment for me because I was, you know, physically thousands and thousands of miles from home, and I was surrounded by people I did not know who spoke another language. And in that moment, I was at home. Right, I had family right there. It was fantastic. And it was a really nourishing moment for me. An outrageously happy moment. So our bodhisattva ideal in Zen practice, in Mahayana Buddhism, is this defiance. That's the form this defiance takes, is our ideal. And when we chant the Bodhisattva vows here in a few minutes, at the end of the talk, we always chant the four vows, kind of feel that in them. Just kind of check in with your body as you're chanting these things. Sort of, you can sort of sense this, the size of the defiance in the words. Beings are numberless, vowing to freedom. What? Like that? That's the response. Here's reality, and here's our response. It's completely unlike anything we normally conceptualize as a logical response. It has a irrational, almost, doesn't it? Rebellion sometimes has that almost, like, nope, gonna do it anyway. That person is just awful. I'm gonna love them anyway, no matter what they do. I'm just gonna love them and 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 love them, no matter what. Isn't it cool to think that defiance can take that form? I will not give in to hate. I will not see you as separate. I just won't go down that road. I absolutely refuse. And every time I see my mind and heart doing it, I'll let it go and come back to the place where we're connected. Of course we're connected. So that's my kind of rebellion, I have to admit. It's a very joyous. There's an unbreakable spirit to that. It flies in the face of our usual understanding of reality. So, the Bodhisattva path has been described by people far wiser than I as the most radical and powerful of all forms of Buddhist practice. And it's radical because it says that our highest happiness in this life is directly connected to the well-being of others. So our kind of I don't know if it's inbred, but it certainly feels instinctual sense to withdraw, to protect the small self. It's a reaction to that. Like, oh, no, that doesn't work. It's the opposite. It's the opposite. Your well-being and the other person's well-being are not two well-beings. So we hear this message, of course, in a lot of different ways. But when we start to actually touch that experience in our bones, something else can open up to us. And that's what I'm meaning today by rebellion. There is a sense that everything I've been doing up till now to protect this small self, all the stories I tell myself to continually separate small self, reinforce small self, strengthen small self, they ultimately don't really work, do they? Something else has to happen. There has to be another way of working with the heart in order to find freedom. Because my freedom and your freedom can't be too. So there's a huge energy there. There's a huge letting go there. And I also think that our, and of course this isn't new, a lot of you have heard variations on this thing, but I also think that our zazen itself, our commitment every day to sit with reality as it is, to work with the churning heart, to work with the grief, to work with the anger, to work with the joy, the happiness, the hope, wanting to go into the world with a quieter mind, a stiller heart, is a radically political thing. It's an incredibly political act. And it doesn't have labels, and it doesn't have t-shirts, and it doesn't have placards, and it doesn't have anything to which it's attached. It's more fundamental than that. And the reason I think it is political is because, you know, one way of looking at this is that the world doesn't need more of anything. It just doesn't need more. It needs less. Right? Less of my greed. Less of my hate. Less of my ignorance. And when I sit on the cushion every day and pull up those roots, pull up those roots, pull up those roots of that greed, of that hate, of that ignorance, I am beginning to transform my heart. And again, because I know how interconnected we all are, that's kind of the front lines for me. Like, that's where I can really, really touch your life, is by seeing the roots of ignorance in my own mind and releasing them, right? Transforming them. I feel like it's an obligation at a certain point to make the heart, to the degree that it will take it, a place of serenity and integrity, right, and peace, because I have to carry that heart out into the world. I can't not. I can't leave it at home. I have to carry that out into the world. It will touch you because it has to touch you. Your heart touches mine. And when we carry this heart that we cultivate on the cushion, when we carry that integrity, when we carry some peace, when we carry openness into the suffering world, we're offering real change, like genuine human-to-human change, aren't we? In that moment, I mean, underneath race stuff, underneath political stuff, underneath Democrat, Republican, underneath gender, underneath age, underneath everything, just an available, present human heart. That really shows up everywhere then, doesn't it? It feels radical to me. So, again, it's refusing the lie. It's saying no to the lie. Our choice to be willing to see the truth is our zazen practice. We're turning our light, the light of our own awareness, the light of our own experiential understanding on our own mind, seeing the motivation behind the thoughts, behind the actions, the real drive behind our life, and becoming willing and disciplined enough to start to change the things that are unskillful. It does take a lot of discipline. Changing consciousness. So, because this type of because this type of defiance is coming from a willingness to connect, it's coming from a place of love, I trust it. It is not coming from a place of division. It is not coming from a place of judgment. It is not coming from a place of one-upsmanship. There's really no ego involved in it. It's a response to reality, which is one of the ways we can describe the Buddhist path. A response to reality. So we don't normally like to think of ourselves in Zen practice or Buddhist practice as having an opposition or an enemy, and I think that's helpful. But if we did have one, it wouldn't be other people, it would be delusion. It wouldn't be other people, it would be ignorance. It would never be another person, it would be greed. And I recognize those qualities in me, and I recognize those qualities in you. But you're not the enemy, and neither am I. Right? And because our practice, our zazen practice, our meditation practice, is designed to change the only person we can change, ourselves, it's incredibly direct and very efficient. I mean, I have to confess, I spend a lot of time that I consider to be probably wasted trying to change other people. I'm sure you do too. I hope you do too. I hope I'm not alone in that. Boy, that seems to never work, and it's amazing how often I go back to it. Changing myself, though, there at least I have a chance. So that's defiant. The second quality today is resilience. And I like resilience a lot. You know, mental resilience, emotional resilience, comes from pliability. And I don't know why it was for me, but the way I finally understood this was around hardening of the arteries. At some point I learned my grandfather had hardening of the arteries. And I was like, so why is that bad? Well, because if they're hard, they can't move, they can't stretch, they can't, right? They lose their efficacy. You know, when the heart muscle begins to become rigid, you're in big trouble, right? The reason that's the strongest muscle is because of its incredible ability to expand and then contract and then expand and then contract and then expand and then contract. Like, its strength comes from its pliability, resiliency. And I kind of, for whatever reason, that was what connected it to me, because I grew up thinking that strong meant, you know, rigid, like the thing that doesn't bend, the thing that doesn't move, the thing that doesn't, right? It's rigid, rigid, rigid. It never changes. You know, you knew Dad was right because his opinion never changed. That's how he's right. Until you eventually figure out, oh, whoops. No, he's dead wrong and just stubborn. Oh, stubborn isn't helpful. I get it. Stubborn is rigid. Stubborn leads to pain and suffering. Ah, because reality's changing all the time, so hanging on to the same thing means you're out of accord with reality. Ah, ta-da. So anyway, that was my epiphany. Resiliency. And we certainly see the connection here between this and zazen practice. You know, zazen is an endlessly fascinating process for me, because no matter how much of it I do, there's that little part of your brain that goes, I know how to do this. That's funny. That's actually funny. I mean, it makes sense that I would think I know how to do it, because I've technically speaking, done it so many times. But the misapprehension there is that somehow it will be in any way similar to anything that's ever gone before. That being present to this moment is no big deal because I've been present to other moments. Oh, I get it. No two moments are the same. So every single time I sit down is the first time. Right? Every single time I sit down. I mean, it really, really is. Our awareness, you know, what they call it now, they don't say pliable, they say elasticity. Have you guys heard that? Like, they say, all the studies now show that meditation is fantastic for the elasticity of mind. Our minds are much more elastic than we would have previously thought possible. People can learn much, much later than they thought, unlearn much, much later than they thought, and presence to immediate felt experience is one of the things that really helps with this flexibility of mind. I don't have to always experience that person in the same way just because I have up till now. I can actually experience them in a different way. So people who start to work with the heart and mind discover, of course, that no two moments are the same, that the skillful response in this moment, by definition, has to be something that comes up in this moment. There's no template for it, ultimately. And that we can actually unlearn the habits of heart and mind that are unskillful, right? Habits like hate, division, separation, ignorance. When we notice ourselves watering the seeds of greed, yet again, we can go, oh yeah, I know you. And I also know from my experience how well you work, which isn't very... I'm going to put you down, and I'm going to go back to something that I've never experienced before, which is, I've never taken this breath before. This moment is absolutely unique. To be present to it by definition means I have to be willing to engage with something I have never engaged in before. Truly. We call it beginner's mind. You guys have heard that, right? Yeah, beginner's mind. And in Zen, they sometimes say that our spiritual security is based on our ability to be with what is. It isn't based on a belief system that I never let go of, or one technique that always worked, because that's not possible. Spiritual security is not my ability to feel comfortable no matter what happens. Nope. My spiritual security is based on my capacity to be with what is. And of course, what is just change. Change, change. And I think in Zazen, you know, we let go of our ideas about reality, we let go of our preconceptions about reality, we let go of the stories that the mind tells about past and future. We're essentially letting go of everything that isn't actually this. And by doing this over and over and over, thousands and thousands of times, naturally we develop a much greater resiliency to be with what is. We become so much more flexible. We're so much less attached to those typical dead-end streets in our minds. Habit-bound mind is what we're letting go of moment after moment. It also, for a lot of us, shows up as an increased sensitivity, an increased depth of feeling. I don't know about you guys, but after I started sitting Zazen and was really hanging in there with it for 6 months or so, it felt like my emotions were way bigger than they were before. And, you know, I don't know, of course, but I'm guessing that they were the same old feelings. I just didn't have as many filters between me and those, right? It wasn't like, oh, right, angry, I know what this is. I put it in a box. No, you've never felt this before. This is something else. This is different. I'm much more available to my experience. So that's our resiliency. That's our spiritual security. Unsentimental is the third word I'm playing with today. And unsentimental, this was a little bit tougher for me because I am self-described as very sentimental. I tend to get very attached to people. I tend to get very attached to objects. I've noticed that about myself. And so unsentimental, I thought, I don't know if I like that idea so much. And I don't really know that years and years of Zen meditation has made me any less sentimental. So what I had to do was pay attention to the word sentimental and kind of get to the spirit of what it was actually meaning. What it isn't meaning is in any way disrespectful. I think sometimes unsentimental showed up in my life, or things that were labeled as sentimental were actually emotional. And by getting rid of that, that somehow felt like, oh yes, I'm beyond such things. No, I don't think that's true. In this case, I think unsentimental just means attached. Unsentimental means free. Sentimental means attached. It's the part of us that wants, that associates an experience with a person or an object and wants that experience back again. And so hangs on to that person or experience, trying to continue to recreate that, right? We can actually get sentimental about our zazen practice. You know, if you have a spectacularly wonderful sitting where the whole universe disappears and collapses into a big golden sphere of loveliness and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas show up and you are wide awake. Well, when that sitting's over and it's time for the next sitting to come up the next day, guess what you want back again? And that black cushion in the corner of your room, that's the ticket. You know, we become attached very quickly as humans, right? It's one of the things we all do. I think we can hold that kindly. I get it. I associate this attachment with feeling good or with becoming free, and actually it's the opposite. The more attached I am to this thing, the less free I become. So unsentimental becomes unattached. Unsentimental, I think, also becomes more open, because I think the way we oftentimes use the word sentimental, I save my love for a chosen few because I'm sentimental, and I can show you the six people about whom I am sentimental, and they're the ones who get all the good stuff. And the rest of you get whatever else is left. Right? In this case, I think unsentimental means boundless. Unsentimental means boundless, which is actually more in accord with reality, right? Love has no boundaries. Love doesn't have limits. I think we oftentimes operate as if I have 10 points of love and I have to spend them really carefully. So I've got to make sure to give at least 5 to my wife. Although my mom's birthday is coming up next week, and my sister's going to be here. So how am I going to? As if somehow there was a finite amount of awareness, a finite amount of compassion, a finite amount of love, a finite amount of affection. And there isn't. So loving in an unsentimental fashion, or practicing in an unsentimental fashion, is the bodhisattva ideal. There is no limit to this, and you offer it out freely. Always, always, always. So, unsentimental practice is about finding our own freedom in our experience, I think. And the last one I'll talk about today is the word exuberant. I discovered when I was writing this talk that I like the word exuberant. I don't use the word exuberant very much. I am dedicating myself to using it more often. Exuberant. There's something fun about saying it. Maybe it's the oob in the middle that's fun to say. Exuberant. My good friend Kimberly, who knows all things Latin, says that the root of this word, exuberant, is uber, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it. She'd know how to say it right. But she says what it means is abundantly fruitful and fertile. And I went, oh, that's perfect for my talk. I was really glad that she said that. Had she said something else, I would have had to not talk about this. But I was really happy about that. Oh, abundantly fruitful, fertile, exuberant. That's interesting. If you had asked me before she told me that, what is exuberant meant, I would have said, really expressive, exuberant, like a 5-year-old going, we're going to go on the roller coaster now, and they go, bloop, 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 and they're jumping up and down, and they can just hardly physically contain the amount of joy and excitement they're feeling because they get to go on the roller coaster, and it's going to be fantastic. They're exuberant. Wow, cool, okay. And I thought, well, maybe that's a tough sell for Zen because we don't do a lot of bouncing. But I thought, well, no, there's something in there. I know this is, somehow I know that this is this joy, just one of the forms that joy takes. Yes, abundantly fruitful and fertile. And I went, oh, well, now there's Zen practice right down the line. And we all know the fruits of meditation practice. We certainly know the fruits of devoting one's life to a path of understanding and compassion. And those fruits are understanding and compassion. We know what the fruits of living a life that's based in joy and connection and intimacy and love are, because the fruits are joy and connection and intimacy and love. It's kind of the magic penny song, the more you spend, the more you get. And joy is really the base of all of it. I honestly think joy is the base of Buddhist practice. I honestly think joy is the base of Zen practice. And although our joy, our exuberance, tends to be expressed in a relatively quiet, still, wall-gazing sort of way, I put it to you that it is no less exuberant than the five-year-old who's running up and down blah, 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 because he gets to go on the roller coaster. There's just a complete engagement with experience there. You know, when that kid is just thrilled about the roller coaster, there is nothing else in the entire universe other than that experience. He's not comparing it to past experiences about possibly getting excited about a roller coaster or hoping, oh, I hope I can hang on to this experience and someday feel this way about another roller coaster. It's just this moment. You know, and he's just burning it completely because there's nothing but that. Burning it so completely that it shows up in his body. Right? Bouncing. Wow. That makes perfect sense to me when I compare that to Zen practice. Just this moment. No past zazens, no future zazens, no concern about where I've been, no concern about where I'm going. Just burning this moment all the way through. And of course it shows up in my body. This is the posture of zazen. Balanced, stable, upright, dignified. The posture of an upright mind. I'm not leaning toward to grab more. I'm not leaning away from to get away from. Equanimity. Willingness to engage in the moment as it's arising, right? Open, receptive heart. It shows up right there. Wow. Zen practice is very energetic. It demands a lot of energy, and it provides us with a lot of energy. So it's practicing with compassion. That's what exuberant is. It's practicing with passion, practicing with compassion. It's funny how those things work together. So I would suggest to you that when you are sitting zazen, that you should sit zazen in an exuberant fashion. I am recommending that. I am recommending, what I mean is that you sit unselfconsciously. Unselfconsciously, in a very literal sense. Don't bring yourself to the zafu. Don't take anything with you at the end of zazen. Just sit zazen, you know, the way you dance when no one's watching. Just completely burn it. Completely burn yourself there on that cushion. Burn it all the way through. Leave nothing. Sit zazen in the way that you laugh when you're trying not to laugh and you can't help it. Like in church. Or during a math lecture. Or whatever your setting is. When something shoots out of your nose, that's the kind of laughing I'm talking about. That can be zazen. It's holding nothing back, is what I'm saying. Holding nothing back. Let your zazen come up from your toes. Let your zazen come up like that wellspring of joy, energy, boredom, grief. It doesn't matter. You're allowing it, allowing it, allowing it all. Let it just come up. Let it come up. Give yourself to it completely. Be as deadly serious about your zazen as you were about your play in the sandbox when you were 2.5. This is the most serious thing in the world, and your grin is so big they can see it a block away. It's that kind of energy, right? It doesn't filter. It doesn't hold anything back. It has no sense of how it's being perceived. It just gives itself. That is really life-sustaining energy for us, isn't it? When we have moments like that, however that shows up in our lives, and I know as adults those moments are fewer and farther between, that makes me sad to say. I think it's true, though. I think Zen practice, when it's done really well, brings you back to that place. It can. What am I scared of? Seriously? Look at your fear. It withers. It'll wither under the light of your awareness. There's nothing there. We can live from this place more often. But then it becomes more like art, when you just put it out. You just put it out because you can't not. Zazen can be like that. It's the exuberance of everything. So, to wrap up, it is just like his review. It is just like this music that comes from Soweto that helped to overturn apartheid. He said the music has to be fully absorbed before it can be believed, much less understood. Now, that's the truest sentence I've ever heard about Zen. No matter how many books you've read about it, maybe they make no sense to you. That's probably a good sign, by the way. Maybe they make a lot of sense to you. Okay, come sit zazen. Zen practice has to be fully absorbed before it can be believed, much less understood. And this is something I'm sure you've all heard. Zen teachers talk about this over and over and over. They always emphasize this absorption. Just absorb it fully. Don't worry about the understanding. Don't worry about the belief. Don't worry about those things. They come or they don't. What's important is the absorption. Get it in your bones. And it is like that record for me because I don't speak a word of Zulu. I don't speak a word of any of the other languages that are on that album. I don't know one word that's on that album, and I've heard it 300 times, I betcha. Understanding the words has no impediment whatsoever for it to keep it from moving me, right? And my heart leaps inside my chest when I hear that music again. Wow! I know exactly what that song is about. Right? Describing the lyrics would diminish what it's actually about. It's much, much, much bigger than that. That's your Zen practice. That's your Zen. It's your life, actually. When you try to describe it to somebody else, doesn't it feel kind of diminished? Isn't it way, way, way bigger than that? Isn't it something that is fundamentally exuberant that refuses to not happen? Isn't your life at the very, very bottom of everything fundamentally rebellious, refusing to say no? All the heartbreak you've experienced, all the grief, all the people who told you no, and yet here you are. Red heart beating in your chest right now, saying no to all those things and doing it anyway. That's the energy. That's the energy. So, our practice is called to be this way. The defiantly resilient and unsentimental exuberance of Zen practice has to be fully absorbed before it can be believed, much less understood. You couldn't be more into it if you were inventing rock and roll. I hope that that's true. And if it isn't, stick around. And thank you very much. That's what I have for you this morning. We still have some time if you'd like to ask questions or share something. Or I guess we'll leave this on for questions. Does anybody have anything they'd like to offer this morning? Does anybody know the album Indestructible Beat of Soleno? All right. Good stuff, right? That's the medicine, yeah. Jim.
Which I like how your starting point was music, because it ends about freeing ourselves, other people, liberating ourselves and other people. I think there's a few things that are more powerful as an aid to that than music. I mean, think of any struggle for liberation. Yeah. Music has been hard, but we shall overcome the civil rights struggle.
Yep.
And I think listening to music, what liberates your own sense of the structure of what music is, also helps liberate yourself and also helps liberate the people around you.
Yeah.
So I just think it's tremendously powerful, music and culture. I think you really can't think about liberation without thinking about culture and music being part of it.
Yeah.
So thank you for your talk. That was very powerful.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm totally with you. I'm actually just beginning to discover the role of individual artistic expression in a cultural sense and beginning to realize, like, how radical that can actually be. One of my teachers, Lyndall Johnson, is from Zimbabwe, born in Zimbabwe, and I've been working with her for, I don't know, a long, long, long time. And she was raised in Zimbabwe and then lived in South Africa. That's where this is during apartheid. And she said, when we were meeting with Bishop Tutu, she was telling me the story. She said, my very favorite story about him, I remember hearing about when I was in high school, because, and I'm going to get the details wrong almost certainly. The way I remember it was a black mother and her child had been murdered in Soweto by a white police officer. And so a mob had gathered, thousands of people can gather in a very, very short amount of time in such a small community like that. And they were on the edge of a riot. They're basically ready to, like, okay, it's time to do something. And they called Archbishop Tutu and said, you've got to go down there and address the crowd. You've got to do something. And he gets down there, and of course, this is like a powder keg. I mean, all they're waiting for is just one person to say one thing, and bang, they're off, and it's going to be a bloodbath. And so he arrives, and doing the best spiritual kung fu I've ever heard, says, put on some music really loud, we're going to dance. He gets that whole crowd, and they turn from a mob bent on destruction into a crowd that's dancing. Now, does that solve the problem ultimately? Do they all go home with peace in their hearts and joy in their eyes? Well, no, but it's exactly what you're talking about, Jim. All of a sudden, they're on the same page, and it's a different page. We're together in our grief. Yeah, we are aching. We are angry. This is real. But there's something else we can do in this moment that actually expresses that in a way that isn't about, let's go grab our guns and go kill people. Right? Then we're feeding right into the same thing that just happened to us. So the simplicity of just turn on the radio really loud and we're going to dance. I went, wow, that's genius. Really, really genius. I thought, oh, jeez, oh, bodhisattva. That's how he shows up. Ellie.
Great talk today, Marty. Really
thank you.
Beautiful. What struck me was our charge is to actively go forth and spread compassion and suffering. I think that this is just totally within that charge
that
you're talking about. And so thank you for giving me another aspect about viewing that.
Yeah.
So I really
well, I'm glad you liked it. It is, isn't it, our charge? Yeah. The Bodhisattva vows are pretty direct, aren't they? Like, this is your job. It's kind of cool to be formally empowered to be able to do that. I mean, isn't the implicit assumption the Bodhisattva vows like, yeah, you can do that. Of course you can.
That's a sense of freedom. You are giving us license.
Isn't it nice? Yeah. Isn't that nice? We give it to each other, too, don't we, when we see... I mean, moments like this brave act that speak of love and commitment to a path of compassion and love just give us energy. And it's like, wow, if that person can do it, she could do that? Well, then I could do that. It is. It's like a license we give each other, kind of, isn't it? Yeah. A license to forgive, a license to live from a bigger place. Yeah. Thank you. That's really helpful. Okay, well, thank you. I know we're running out of time here, so I'll turn the things over to our lovely Dawn.